Chapter 7, Feeding the Minotaur. Name and operator's number. Perkins, David. Pinky. AGD136-323. Address. Care of Perkins and Snell Detective Series. Induction date. September 1957. Notes. Perkins joined the service and has shown exemplary conduct throughout his service career. After signing up for a 20-year tour of duty, he extended that to another tour in 1977. After 5 years heading the Misspelling Protection Squad, he was transferred to Grammar Site Inspection and Eradication and in 1981 took over leadership of the Grammar Site Research Facility. Entry from Juris Fiction Service Record. Abridged. I found myself in a large meadow next to a babbling brook. Willows and larches hung over the crystal-clear waters, while mature oaks punctuated the land. It was warm and dry and quite delightful. Like a perfect summer's day in England, in fact, and I suddenly felt quite homesick.
"I used to look at the view a lot," said a voice close at hand. "Don't seem to have the time these days."
I turned to see a tall and laconic man leaning against a silver birch, holding a copy of the Juris Fiction trade paper, movable type. I recognized him, although we had never been introduced. It was Perkins, who partnered Snell at Juris Fiction, much as they did in the Perkins and Snell series of detective novels.
"Hello,"
he said, proffering a hand and smiling broadly. "Put it there. Perkins is the name. Acrid tells me you sorted Hopkins out good and proper." "Thank you. Acrid's very kind, but it isn't over yet." He cast an arm towards the horizon. "What do you think?" I looked at the view. High, snow-capped mountains rose in the distance above a green and verdant plain. At the foot of the hills were forests, and a large river wended its way through the valley. "Beautiful. We bought it from the fantasy division of the Well of Lost Plots. It's a complete world in itself, written for a sword and sorcery novel entitled The Sword of the Zenobians. Beyond the mountains are icy wastes, deep fjords and relics of long-forgotten civilizations, castles, that sort of stuff. It was auctioned off when the book was abandoned. There were no characters or events written in, which was a shame, considering the work he did on the world itself. This might have been a bestseller. Still, the Outland's loss is our gain. We use it to keep gramicites and other weird beasts who for one reason or another can't live safely within their own books."
"Sanctuary?"
"Yes, and also for study and containment. Hence the password." "There seems to be an awful lot of rabbits," I observed, looking around.
"Ah, yes," replied Perkins, crossing a stone-arched bridge that spanned the small stream. "We never did get the lid on reproduction within Watership Down. If left to their own devices, the book would be so full of dandelion-munching lagomorphs that every other word would be rabbit within a year. Still, Lenny enjoys it here when he has some time off."
We walked up a path towards a ruined castle. Grass covered the mounds of masonry that had collapsed from the curtain wall, and the wood of the drawbridge had rotted and fallen into a moat now dry and full of brambles. Above us, what appeared to be ravens circled the highest of the remaining towers.
"Not birds," said Perkins, handing me a pair of binoculars. "Have a look."
I peered up at the circling creatures who were sawing on large wings of stretched skin. "Perentheums?"
"Very good. I have 6 breeding pairs here. Purely for research, I hasten to add. Most books can easily support 40 or so with no ill effects. It's just when the numbers get out of hand that we have to take action. A swarm of gramicites can be pretty devastating."
"I know. I was almost..."
"Watch out!"
He pushed me aside as a lump of excrement splattered on the ground near where I had been standing. I looked up at the battlements and saw a man-beast covered in coarse, dark hair who glared down at us and made a strangled cry in the back of his throat.
"Yahoos!" explained Perkins with disdain. "They're not terribly well-behaved and quite beyond training."
"From Gulliver's Travels?"
"Bingo! When truly original works like Jonathan Swift's are made into new books, characters are often duplicated for evaluation and consultative purposes. Characters can be retrained, but creatures usually end up here. Yahoos are not exactly a favourite of mine, but they're harmless enough, so the best thing to do is ignore them."
We walked quickly under the keep,
to avoid any other possible missiles and entered the inner bailey, where a pair of centaurs were grazing peacefully. They looked up at us, smiled and waved and carried on eating. I noticed that one of them was listening to a walkman. "You have centaurs here?"
"And satyrs, troglodytes, chimeras, elves, fairies, dryads, sirens, Martians, leprechauns, goblins, harpies, aliens, Daleks, trolls, you name it."
Perkins smiled.
"A large proportion of unpublished novels are in the fantasy genre, and most of them feature mythical beasts. Whenever one of those books gets demolished, I can usually be found down at the salvage yard. It would be a shame to reduce them to text now, wouldn't it?"
"Do you have unicorns?"
"Yes," sighed Perkins. "Sack loads. More than I know what to do with. I wish potential writers would be more responsible with their creations. I can understand children writing about them, but adults should know better. Every unicorn in every demolished story ends up here. I had this idea for a bumper sticker. A unicorn isn't for page 27, it's for eternity. What do you think?"
"I think you won't be able to stop people writing about them. How about taking the horn off and seeking placement in pony books?"
"I'll pretend I didn't hear that," replied Perkins stonily, adding, "We have dragons, too. We can hear them sometimes, at night when the wind is in the right direction. When, or if, Pellinore captures the questing beast, it will come to live here. Somewhere a long way away, I hope. Careful, don't tread in the orc shit. You're an outlander, aren't you? Born and bred. Has anyone realized that platypuses and seahorses are fictional?"
"Are they?"
"Of course. You don't think anything that weird could have evolved by chance, do you? By the way, how do you like Miss Havisham?"
"I like her a great deal."
"So do we all. I think she quite likes us too, but she'd never admit it."
We had arrived at the inner keep and Perkins pushed open the door. Inside was his office and laboratory. One wall was covered with glass jars filled with odd creatures of all shapes and sizes, and on the table was a partially dissected gramacite. Within its gut were words being digested into letters.
"I'm not really sure how they do it," said Perkins, prodding at the carcass with a spoon. "Have you met Matthias?"
I looked around but could see nothing but a large chestnut horse whose flanks shone in the light. The horse looked at me and I looked at the horse, then past the horse, but no one else was in the room. The penny dropped.
"Good morning, Matthias,"
I said as politely as I could.
"I'm Thursday next."
Perkins laughed out loud and the horse brayed and replied in a deep voice,
"Delighted to make your acquaintance, madam. Permit me to join you in a few moments."
I agreed, and the horse returned to what I now saw were some complicated notes it was writing in a ledger open on the floor. Every now and then it paused and dipped the quill that was attached to its hoof into an inkpot and wrote in a large copperplate script.
"A Hooney Hinnom?" I asked. "Also from Gulliver's Travels?"
Perkins nodded.
"Matthias, his mare, and the two yahoos were all used as consultants for Pierre Boulle's 1963 remake La Planète des Singes."
"Louis Aragon once said,"
announced Matthias from the other side of the room,
"that the function of geniuses was to furnish cretins with ideas 20 years on."
"I hardly think that Boulle was a cretin, Matthias," said Perkins. "And anyway, it's always the same with you, isn't it? Voltaire said this, Baudelaire said that. Sometimes I think that you just...
He stopped trying to think of the right words.
"Was it Da Vinci who said,"
suggested the horse helpfully,
"that anyone who quotes authors in discussion is using their memory, not their intellect?"
"Exactly," replied the frustrated Perkins. "What I was about to say.
Tempora mutantur et nos mutamur in illis," murmured the horse,
staring at the ceiling in thought.
"The only thing that proves is how pretentious you are," muttered Perkins. "It's always the same when we have visitors, isn't it?"
"Someone has to raise the tone in this miserable backwater," replied Matthias. "And if you call me a pseudo-erudite ungulate again, I shall bite you painfully on the buttock."
Perkins and the horse glared at one another.
You said there was a pair of Hui Hinnoms? I asked, trying to defuse the situation.
My partner, my love, my mare, explained the horse, is currently at Oxford, your Oxford, studying political science at All Souls.
Don't they notice? I asked. A horse? At Oxford?
You'd be surprised how unobservant some of the professors are, replied Perkins.
Napoleon the Pig studied Marxism at Nuffield, got a first, too. This way. I keep the Minotaur in the dungeons. You are fully conversant with the legend.
Of course, I replied. It's the half-man, half-bull offspring of King Minos's wife, Pasiphae.
Spot on, Perkins chuckled. The tabloids had a field day. Cretan queen in bull love child shock.
We built a copy of the labyrinth to hold it, but the Monsters Humane Society insisted two officials inspect it first. And?
That was over 12 years. I think they're still in it. I keep the Minotaur in here.
He opened a door that led into a vaulted room below the old hall. It was dark and smelt of rotten bones and sweat.
Do you keep it locked up?
I asked as my eyes struggled to see in the semi-dark.
Of course, he replied, nodding towards a large key hanging from a hook. What do you think I am, an idiot?
As my eyes became accustomed to the gloom, I could see that the back half of the vault was caged off with rusty iron bars. A door in the centre was secured with a ridiculously large padlock.
Don't get too near, warned Perkins as he took a steel bowl from the shelf.
I've been feeding him on yogurt for almost 5 years, and to be truthful, he's getting a bit bored.
Yogurt?
With some bran mixed in. Feeding him on Grecian virgins was too expensive.
Wasn't he slain by Theseus?
I asked, as a dark shape started moving at the back of the vault, accompanied by a low growling noise. Even with the bars, I really wasn't happy to be there.
Usually, replied Perkins, ladling out some yogurt.
But mischievous generics took him out of a copy of Graves's The Greek Myths in 1944 and dropped him in Stalingrad. A sharp-eyed jurisdiction agent figured out what was going on and we took him out. He's been here ever since.
Perkins filled the steel bowl with yogurt, mixed in some bran from a large dustbin, and then placed the bowl on the floor a good 5 feet from the bars. He pushed the dish the remainder of the way with the handle of a floor mop. As we watched, the Minotaur appeared from the dark recesses of the cage, and I felt the hair bristle on the back of my neck. His large and muscular body was streaked with dirt, and sharpened horns sprouted from his bull-like head. He moved with the low gait of an ape, using his forelegs to steady himself. As I watched, he put out 2 clawed hands to retrieve the bowl, then slunk off to a dark corner. I caught a glimpse of his fangs in the dim light, and a pair of deep yellow eyes that glared at me with hungry malevolence.
"I'm thinking of calling him Norman," murmured Perkins. "Come on, I want to show you something."
We left the dark and fetid area beneath the old hall and walked back into the laboratory, where Perkins opened a large leather-bound book that was sitting on the table.
"This is the jurisfiction bestiary," he explained,
turning the page to reveal a picture of the grammar site we had encountered in Great Expectations.
"An adjectivore," I murmured. "Very good. Fairly common in the well, but under control in fiction generally."
He turned a page to reveal a sort of anglerfish, but instead of a light dangling on a one sticking out of its head, it had the indefinite article.
"Nounfish," explained Perkins. "They swim the outer banks of the Tect Sea, hoping to attract and devour stray nouns eager to start an embryonic sentence."
He turned the page to reveal a picture of a small maggot.
"A bookworm?"
I suggested, having seen these before at my Uncle Mycroft's workshop.
"Indeed, not strictly a pest and actually quite necessary to the existence of the bookworld. They take words and expel alternate meanings like a hot radiator. I think earthworms are the nearest equivalent in the outland. They aerate the soil, yes?"
I nodded.
"Bookworms do the same job down here. Without them, words would have one meaning and meanings would have one word. They live in thesauri, but their benefit is felt throughout fiction."
"So why are they considered a pest?"
"Useful, but not without their drawbacks.
get too many bookworms in your novel, and the language becomes almost unbearably flowery.
I've read books like that, I confessed.
He turned the page and I recognised the grammar sites that had swarmed through the well earlier.
Verbicide, he said with a sigh. To be destroyed without mercy. Once the verbicide extracts the verb from a sentence, it generally collapses. Do that once too often and the whole narrative falls apart like a bread roll in a rainstorm.
Why do they wear waistcoats and stripy socks?
To keep warm, I should imagine.
Ah, what about the misspelling virus? Spelt of vicarious molesworthian, murmured Perkins, moving to where a pile of dictionaries were stacked up around a small glass jar. He picked out the container and showed it to me. A thin purple haze seemed to wisp around inside. It reminded me of one of Spike's SEBs.
This is the last of the virus, explained Perkins. We had to destroy the wrist. Watch this.
He picked up a letter opener and delicately brought it towards the virus. As I watched, the opener started to twist and change shape until it looked more like a miniature sheaf of papers. An operetta, complete with libretto and score. I think it was the Pirates of Penzance, but I can't be sure.
The virus works on a subtextual level and distorts the meaning of a word, explained Perkins, removing the operetta, which morphed back to its previous state. The misspelling arises as a consequence of this.
He replaced the jar back in the dicto safe. So the misspelling itself is really only a symptom of sense distortion?
Exactly so. The virus was rampant before Agent Johnson's dictionary in 1744, added Perkins. Lavinia Webster and the Oxford English Dictionary keep it all in check, but we have to be careful. We used to contain any outbreak and offload it in the Molesworth series, where no one ever notices. These days we destroy any new virus with a battery of dictionaries we keep on the 17th floor of the Great Library. But we can't be too careful. Every misspelling you come across has to be reported to the cat on a form S12.
There was a raucous blast from a car horn from outside.
Time's up, Perkins smiled. That will be Miss Havisham.
Miss Havisham was not on her own. She was sitting in a vast automobile, the bonnet of which stretched 10 feet in front of her. The large spoked and unguarded wheels carried tyres that looked woefully skinny and inadequate. 8 huge exhaust pipes sprouted from either side of the bonnet, joined into one and stretched the length of the body. The tail of the car was pointed like a boat, and just forward of the rear wheels 2 huge drive sprockets carried the power to the rear axle on large chains. It was a fearsome beast. It was the 27-litre Higham Special.